A new movie called The Messenger explores the drama that takes place beyond the battlefield. Our film critic Bob Mondello says it's a small film about big emotions.
Staff Sergeant Will Montgomery is a decorated war hero, recently home after surviving a roadside attack in Iraq. As Ben Foster plays him, he's wrapped really tight from stress, post-traumatic or otherwise, and just 3 months away from civilian status when his commander tells him he must now render some of his most valuable service to his country.
I'm assigning you to a casualty notification team.
Sir.
I just want to make myself very clear that although most of your time will remain occupied by your other duties, CNO is to be your absolute priority. This mission is not simply important. It is sacred.
Sir, if I may.
Go ahead.
I've never received any grief counseling, let alone given it. I'm not a religious man, sir.
We are just there for notification, not God, not heaven.
That's Captain Tony Stone, a career soldier, recovering alcoholic, and now Will's more experienced partner. Played by Woody Harrelson, Stone has an easy wit. He seems pretty relaxed generally. But he's firm on the rules for notifications. Avoid physical contact. Don't talk to anyone other than next of kin. No friends, neighbors, mistresses. And for everyone's sake, park down the block, not in front of the home.
You never want to park too close. They hear a car park. Go to the window, see two soldiers getting out. It's just a minute of torture. Now, I should warn you, some of them do have guns.
There are 6 notifications in the film, and the reactions of family members run the gamut you'll expect. Fury, shock, denial, anguish, sometimes expressed, sometimes fiercely held in. You've seen these moments before in movies, but the folks who bear the bad tidings have always been on the other side of the door. Here, they're the focus, and that changes things. Ben Foster and Woody Harrelson are pretty riveting as the notifiers, especially when they're breaking the rules they've set for themselves, getting involved, say, with a widow after notifying her, establishing that though messengers with the worst possible message, they remain alive and lively. First-time director Oren Moverman ropes you into their mindset by stages. He looks at their downtime, shows you how they protect themselves from the pain they're delivering, how they keep everything, even each other, at arm's length, and how that can't last. I'm Bob Mondello.
For nearly 2 years, the U.S. economy has been battered by a recession brought on by excessive borrowing. Millions of people took on far too much mortgage debt or maxed out their credit cards. We were supposed to learn a lesson from this crisis. We were going to embrace the new frugality. But a study released recently shows most Americans still don't have even modest savings. Joining us to discuss life without a financial safety net is NPR senior business editor Marilyn G. Wax. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Hi, Leanne.
Elaborate on the results of this study.
A couple of professors, one's from Harvard and the other one was from Dartmouth, conducted this survey to see how many households could round up $2,000 within 30 days in case they had an emergency. Say your car breaks down or you have a major house repair that involves plumbing or whatever. And they found that people said about half of all Americans said they couldn't scrounge up $2,000 even if they turned to their relatives for help. So if you face an emergency like that, you pretty much have to either start selling some things or going to credit cards.
What's wrong with a credit card?
A few years ago, it was very easy to get credit. In fact, as we now realize, it was probably way too easy. But these days, borrowing money is pretty tough. Real estate values are down a lot, so a home equity loan is not an option for a lot of people. And even if you do have a credit card, the fees, the interest rates, they're so high these days, 20-30%, even more. So you don't want to let a small emergency like a car breakdown turn into some huge financial catastrophe because you're being pulled down by these interest payments and fees. It just makes a lot more sense to have some savings so that you can handle small emergencies.
But I thought that in this recession that people were saving more.
Well, it's certainly true that before the recession began, the personal savings rate was effectively zero. And now that people have seen so many others losing their jobs, the savings rate is back up a little bit to 3-4%, but it's still really low by historic standards. And the researchers say that most of us continue to live with what they call financial fragility, That is, you may appear to have a middle-class lifestyle, but really you're pretty much one pink slip or one car breakdown away from falling into real financial trouble.
Why do so many people live on the financial edge?
It's funny, the people who lived through the Depression, they grew up in all those hard times, but yet they're the ones who tended to save and really take the message that you need a rainy day fund. But the baby boomers grew up in a time when jobs were relatively plentiful, credit was pretty easy. And, you know, of course, the grandchildren of the Depression people, they grew up at a time when lenders thought it was a great idea to get college students to take out credit cards. So we've just sort of step by step, generation by generation, gotten more accustomed to this idea of easy credit. And I called one of the professors, Anna Lusardi at Dartmouth, and I asked her about it. And she said, this has led to a kind of financial illiteracy. We don't read the fine print. We don't really think about compounding interest. And so people have kind of lost track of the financial risks.
So help us out. How do you build up a $2,000 rainy day fund?
It's, you know, it's pretty much the same thing as going on a diet. You just have to be slow and steady and persistent. And, you know, if you have a household where there's two wage earners, if each of those two people just put, let's say they put $20 in a cookie jar every time they listen to Lee Ann Hansen on Sunday mornings, by the end of 1 year, that couple would have $2,000. So, you know, you can do it, but you've got to find that $20. Now, it sounds like a lot of money, but think about it. If you pack your lunch, you carpool, there's all kinds of ways to trim a bit. And it may be annoying at the time, but it's a lot less annoying than getting on a debt treadmill that leads you into deep debt.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax. Thanks a lot, Marilyn.
Oh, you're welcome.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. If you're driving at the moment and you're using a GPS system for navigation, you can thank a small and somewhat secretive branch of the Pentagon. It's called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA for short. Now, aside from the GPS system, DARPA has, over the past 50 years, brought us things like the internet, robotic arms, self-driving cars, and prototypes of supersonic spaceships. Now, for most of those years, DARPA's been off-limits to reporters, but Michael Belfiore managed to get in and write about the agency. His new book is called The Department of Mad Scientists, and Michael Belfiore joins me from New York. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
How did DARPA come about?
DARPA came about for the same reason that NASA did. In 1957, the Soviets launched Sputnik, caused a great amount of consternation at the Defense Department as well as many other places in the United States, and was felt very strongly we have to do something. The Eisenhower administration ultimately had in mind a big, sprawling, well, what became a big bureaucracy, NASA, but they wanted to do something that would get into effect much faster. So they came out with ARPA, it was called at the time. Didn't have D for defense, but it's the same agency. And the idea was to get a bunch of people in a room and get them cooking up ideas for defeating the Soviets in space. NASA came along and later in 58 took over the space mission. And so they moved into other areas, such as information technology.
And eventually, as I mentioned earlier, scientists and researchers there went on to create what we now know as the internet and things like GPS.
That's right. They don't have any of their own laboratories. They just have people coming up with the ideas. These are PhDs, research scientists, as you mentioned, who just come up with the ideas. Then they go out into the field and they find people at universities, at private companies, who can actually put those ideas together.
I want to ask you about some of the gadgets and things you came across working on this book. Things like self-driving cars, do they work?
Self-driving cars do work. And this is actually, I think, a great success story for DARPA. The idea is they want to develop cars that can drive themselves through war zones so we don't have human drivers at risk. But this is part of what makes DARPA very interesting to me. They don't just own the technology after they create it. The institutions that they hire to do the work of creating things then have the right to go and develop these things on their own for the most part and to market them to the public. So DARPA sponsored three auto races that were driven by self-driving cars. And the latest one was in 2007. I watched these cars drive through city streets, stop at stop signs, signal their turns, stay within the speed limit. It's a very strange auto race. And these are starting to roll out, these technologies, in commercial vehicles, production vehicles. So you don't have to go all the way to fully autonomous to get benefits. You can have a car that can sense an impending collision and warn a driver of it, or perhaps even actually automatically swerve your vehicle away from a potential accident.
So the technology is there already.
It's absolutely there, yeah.
We've talked about things that are great and indispensable, but is there a dark side, in a sense, to some of the projects that have come out of DARPA or DARPA research?
Some of the work that DARPA is doing, I'm sure, is quite nasty. I was only allowed to see about half of what they do. So about 50%, I'm told, of what DARPA is doing is off limits to any outsider.
I mean, but we can assume that there are certain projects and weapons that they might be working on that could be incredibly effective and also destructive.
I've got just a glimpse of some of that. They're working on bullets that can guide themselves. So sort of missile technology compressed into the size of a bullet. So you just sort of fire your weapon in the general direction of where you want it to go and it guides itself. They're also working on robotizing insects. So if you can implant very small electronics and control systems into insects, then you can use them as mini UAVs, mini unmanned vehicles.
The title of your book is The Department of Mad Scientists. So talk a little bit about the culture inside of DARPA.
I called the book The Department of Mad Scientists because they have a philosophy that unless something is so out there that a lot of people think it's impossible, it's probably not worth working on as a project. And when Tony Tether came in to DARPA, this was the director of DARPA who was there when I was writing the book. He's no longer there. But when he came in, his mission, as he saw it, was to keep this culture where people ran around, as he said, with their hair on fire, meaning that they were thinking so hard about so many extraordinary things that their hair, their brain overheated and their hair caught on fire. And there is a bit of that feeling there. Of course, literally, they're not running around, you know, cackling and you know, working with bubbling beakers of noxious smelling fumes. The idea is, though, that they are kind of hanging it out there. And this is a time, I think, that we're living in that's analogous to that time in the late 50s when we perceived this threat from the Soviets, this new threat from outer space. We're facing global warming. We're facing energy reserves that are controlled by hostile countries. And I think you need to really push the envelope to solve those things. And I think that DARPA exemplifies the kind of, you know, let's go for broke attitude that you don't see in a lot of places. And I think that we're going to need to see.
That's Michael Belfiore. He's the author of The Department of Mad Scientists. Speaking with me from New York, Michael Belfiore, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. This week, the Senate is expected to release its version of health care overhaul legislation. Questions remain about what a Senate bill will look like. At issue, provisions for government-sponsored health insurance, also known as the public option. The House narrowly passed its own bill earlier this month, which requires every state to participate in such a program. A proposal in the Senate would allow states to opt out of this plan. Republican Jim Douglas is the governor of Vermont. He's also chairman of the National Governors Association, and he joins us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Welcome to the program, Governor.
Well, thanks for having me.
Briefly explain what the opt-out provision is and how it would work.
Well, you probably should ask the proponents to explain it, but as I understand it, the Congress would establish a so-called public option, a publicly run insurance program, and then allow states not to participate. To be perfectly honest, I don't think it's much of an option at all. It seems to me that if a program is offered by the federal government, much as the recovery dollars were earlier this year, then it's unlikely any state is going to opt out.
What are you hearing from your fellow governors about this?
Well, I think the reaction is mixed, frankly. Some governors think it's a good idea. Some don't. It may be largely along partisan lines, to be perfectly honest. But really, Leanne, the governors are not as focused on the public option question as some in the media are. We're more focused on the unfunded mandate and the impact on the fiscal stability and budgets of the states. That's really what's going to matter to governors most.
There have been many governors who had voiced concerns about whether states will be left footing the bill for the expansion of Medicaid as part of the proposed overhaul. Can you explain that issue for us?
That's a real problem because Medicaid is, in some states, the most expensive public program they have, or at least nearly so in many others. And with health inflation as rampant as it is, the cost of that program continues to increase at a time when states can least afford it. So an unfunded mandate from Washington, a requirement that states extend Medicaid benefits to more residents without the full federal support to pay for it, is going to put real pressure on state budgets.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jim Douglas, the governor of Vermont and chairman of the National Governors Association. You were in part responsible for overhauling Vermont's health care system beginning in 2006. How does the system work in Vermont?
I think it works quite well and, frankly, could be a model for the nation. We launched in 03 initially something called the Blueprint for Health. That's a focus on wellness, on early detection and screening, on preventive care, on chronic disease management. I realized at the time that our Medicaid budget was headed for unsustainability. We got permission from the federal government to redeploy our Medicaid dollars for preventive care. And we've seen a significant decline in hospital utilization by Medicaid participants in trips to the emergency room and in the dollars we're expending. Secondly, we have a community health team that coordinates the care for each individual person, and we provide payment incentives for following that model. We have all the public participants except Medicare participating and all of our private insurers. This has improved the quality of care. It's beginning to contain costs, especially in our Medicaid program. And I think that's really where the national debate ought to be. There's so much distraction about a public option and things of that sort. But really what's going to make a difference in the long run is the kinds of reforms we put in place here. That's what's going to bend the cost curve and, I think more importantly, improve the health of the American people.
Would your health care system be affected by federally mandated reforms?
Well, less so than in most other places because we have such an expanded Medicaid program now, the financial impact will be fairly small. So when I argue against the unfunded mandates, it's on behalf of my colleagues in the National Governors Association, some of whom would see huge increases in their state budgets, perhaps as much as $1 billion.
What lessons did you learn from drafting health care legislation on a state level that could apply to the current debate?
I think the most important thing is to focus on bending the cost curve and recognizing that 75% or 80% of the cost of health care in America is for chronic disease. As an aging society, we're going to see more of that because statistically, older Americans are more likely to have one or more chronic illnesses. So we have to, as the gangster in the 30s said, go where the money is. And that means bending that cost curve by managing chronic disease more successfully. First of all, we should try to prevent chronic disease, and that means making sure that we focus on nutrition, on fitness, on wellness, on ensuring that everybody is screened for chronic disease and gets a regular physical exam. These things are not sexy. They don't result in a quick political victory, but in the long run, as we've seen since we launched our Blueprint for Health reforms in 03, it really does bend that cost curve and, I think, improve things. And twice now, by the National Health Foundation, Vermont's been designated the healthiest state. So our reforms, I think, are working here and could be a model for the rest of the country.
Jim Douglas is the governor of Vermont and chairman of the National Governors Association. He joined us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It was DARPA, or rather ARPA, as it was known in 1969, that funded the first computer network. The system was called the ARPANET, and it was to the Internet what the Neanderthal is to modern man. As part of our series, The Net at 40, we're exploring the ideas behind it and talking with the people who helped build it. And before we meet our next guest, let me ask you this question. When was the last time you actually put pen to paper and mailed off a personal letter to someone? I can't remember the last time I did, and of course the reason is email. Now, back in 1971, Ray Tomlinson was working on a system that would allow him to send messages from one computer to another. And he needed a way to separate the name of the sender from the name of the computer so the addresses wouldn't get confused. He decided to use the at symbol. Tomlinson's messaging system eventually became the email that we use today. And Ray Tomlinson is in Boston. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Could you ever have imagined that the system you were working on in 1971 would change the way we all communicate today?
I guess I could have imagined it. What I didn't imagine was how quickly that would happen. What it took was a very marked growth in networks and computers to make it all happen.
And what were you trying to do in 1971?
Well, in 1971, I was busily trying to find things to use this newfangled network for. I heard about a proposal to send messages to be printed with a printer and stuffed away in mailboxes for people to read. And I said, these messages should go to computers. And so I thought about it for a bit and then decided to put together a system that might do that.
And so you were just kind of doing this on your own. Nobody said, hey, Ray, can you invent email?
And the statement of work did not say, thou shalt go forth and invent email. But we were working on ways in which humans and computers could interact and try to improve that interaction.
Do you remember what your first email said?
Well, everybody asked that. And, of course, I don't remember every single word of it. The main thing is there were lots of test messages. You know, these things don't work out of the box because there was no box. Every time you test, you have to generate some kind of a message. And you might drag your fingers across the keyboard or just type the opening phrase from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address or something else. So technically, the first email is completely forgettable and therefore forgotten.
Who did your first message go to?
All the test messages were sent to myself. I had two computers that were literally side by side. The keyboards were about 10 feet apart. And I could wheel my chair from one to the other and type a message in one and then go to the other and see what I had tried to send.
Now, why did you pick the at sign, this iconic symbol? How did you pick that symbol?
Yeah, well, it certainly wasn't an icon back in 1971. But it was a key on the keyboard that did not appear in users' names, not appear in host names. It made sense. It's a preposition. It means user at host. It is the only preposition on the keyboard.
So did you become a internet billionaire from this?
No, I didn't.
You're not a billionaire today?
Not by several more orders of magnitude.
Hundreds of millions?
No, I've often thought about what it would have taken, what fraction of a cent per at sign would it take to make me very comfortable. And it's a very small fraction.
So, Ray Tomlinson, do you feel comfortable with the title Ray Tomlinson, Inventor of Email?
Oh, yeah, you can call me that.
Fair enough. That's Ray Tomlinson, the inventor of email and a principal engineer at Bolt, Beranek, and Newman, now known as BBN Technologies. You can find out more about the invention of email at our website. That's npr.org. Ray Tomlinson, thanks very much.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm glad I had this opportunity to speak to you and your audience.
The H1N1 flu virus is now the dominant influenza virus around the globe, according to the World Health Organization. The agency has declared the swine flu outbreak a pandemic, with nearly 500,000 confirmed cases and over 6,000 deaths reported worldwide. For more on the virus's global impact, we're joined by Dr. Anthony Mounts. He's team lead for pandemic monitoring and surveillance with the World Health Organization, and he joins us from Geneva, Switzerland. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you.
How would you characterize the global spread of the H1N1 virus?
It has been incredibly fast, actually. I think faster than anyone would have predicted in the beginning before it started. It's already spread through the Southern Hemisphere countries where they recently had winter. So now what we're seeing in the Northern Hemisphere, I think, is just the mirror image of that. It's now approaching winter time. It's normal flu season. Conditions are right for the transmission of the virus, and so you're seeing a rapid rise.
Do you see any links between the people who have died from the virus? I mean, pre-existing conditions, certain vulnerability?
Yes, there is. I mean, there's definitely an association. People that die of this virus are much more likely to have underlying medical conditions like diabetes, chronic lung disease, emphysema, chronic bronchitis, asthma, those kind of things. And in children, the children that are particularly vulnerable are those with respiratory problems like asthma, but also children with cerebral palsy or severe neurological problems.
Is it possible for you to break out those numbers of the 6,000 who have died? Like, how many were children? How many were elderly?
I can't exactly break out the numbers, but I can tell you who's at highest risk. We know from looking at a variety of countries' data that children under the age of 5 are really at highest risk for requiring hospitalization, for having severe disease. but they're not at highest risk of death. It's actually the age group between 50 and 59, or 50 to 65, that range.
Dr. Malsum, I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that those between 50 and 59 are more susceptible to death, because that is not the risk group that is being vaccinated.
You know, the vaccination strategies, it depends on what you're trying to accomplish with vaccination. There is some evidence that you can actually prevent transmission of the virus if you vaccinate school-aged children, for example. So even though they may not be at highest risk for dying or even being hospitalized, by vaccinating them, you may protect older individuals just because there's less transmission. I mean, children of school age are certainly more likely to get infected and probably transmit a lot more of the virus in the community than any other age group. This strategy for vaccination depends on a lot more factors than just individual risk.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Anthony Mounts, a flu specialist with the World Health Organization. Where are we in the virus's proliferation cycle? I mean, do you see it reaching a peak? Is it nearing a peak?
I believe it is in North America. We've been looking at some of the information from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and it looks like parts of the U.S. at least, it's starting to peak, perhaps in the southeast. It's a little bit too early to tell. I think you need another week or so to watch. But further north in Canada, it's still spreading. I don't think it's peaked yet. It's spreading eastward from British Columbia across Canada. In Europe, in the temperate zones of Europe, it's still spreading eastward from Western Europe.
In many places across the United States, demand for the H1N1 vaccine is outpacing supply. Can you assess the level of preparedness and vaccine supplies on a global scale?
Well, we've known forever, I guess, that vaccine supplies wouldn't be sufficient to vaccinate everyone. And so the focus has been on vaccinating those at higher risk. And many of the countries that pre-ordered vaccine in the beginning at the onset of the pandemic have now volunteered donations of large supplies of vaccines for developing countries. And the focus in all of those countries really is to protect the most vulnerable, pregnant women, people with chronic medical conditions, and so on.
Later this month, Muslims from around the world will gather in Saudi Arabia for the annual Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. How is the Saudi government preparing, given concerns about the spread of the virus?
I think they've got a pretty good plan. They've made some recommendations to countries that send pilgrims to the Hajj about people that should and shouldn't come. And there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of preparations now.
Dr. Anthony Mounts is team lead for pandemic monitoring and surveillance with the World Health Organization. He joined us from Geneva, Switzerland. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're listening to NPR News.